the true scientist will allow himself or herself to expand into a frame of reference from which the answers that he or she is seeking can be understood. We, as a species, have been asking the questions, is there a God? Is there a divine intelligence? And is there a purpose to life? For as long as we have been able to articulate questions, the time has now come for us to expand into a frame of reference that allows these questions to be answered. The larger frame of reference of the multisensory human allows an understanding of the experientially meaningful distinction between the personality and the soul. Your personality is that part of you that was born into, lives within, and will die within time. To be a human and to have a personality are the same thing. Your personality, like your body, is the vehicle of your evolution. The decisions that you make and the actions that you take upon the earth are the means by which you evolve. At each moment, you choose the intentions that will shape your experiences and those things upon which you will focus your attention. These choices affect your evolutionary process. This is so for each person. If you choose unconsciously, you evolve unconsciously. If you choose consciously, you evolve consciously. The fearful and violent emotions that have come to characterize human existence can be experienced only by the personality. Only the personality can feel anger, fear, hatred, vengeance, sorrow, shame, regret, indifference, frustration, cynicism, and loneliness. Only the personality can judge, manipulate, and exploit. Only the personality can pursue external power. The personality can also be loving, compassionate, and wise in its relations with others. But love, compassion, and wisdom do not come from the personality. They are experiences of the soul. The soul is that part of you that is immortal. Every person has a soul, but a personality that is limited in its perception to the five senses is not aware of its soul, and therefore cannot recognize the influences of its soul. As a personality becomes multisensory, its intuitions, its hunches and subtle feelings become important to it. It senses things about itself, other people, and the situations in which it finds itself that it cannot justify on the basis of the information that its five senses can provide. It comes to recognize intentions and to respond to them rather than to the actions and the words that it encounters. It can recognize, for example, a warm heart beneath a harsh and angry manner and a cold heart beneath polished and pleasing words. When a multisensory personality looks inside itself, it finds a multitude of different currents. Through experience, it learns to distinguish between these currents and to identify the emotional, psychological, and physical effects of each. It learns, for example, which currents produce anger, divisive thoughts, and destructive actions, and which currents produce love, healing thoughts, and constructive action. In time, it learns to value and to identify with those currents that generate creativity, healing, and love, and to challenge and release those currents that create negativity, disharmony, and violence. In this way, a personality comes to experience the energy of its soul. Your soul is not a passive or a theoretical entity that occupies a space in the vicinity of your chest cavity. It is a positive, purposeful force at the core of your being. It is that part of you that understands the impersonal nature of the energy dynamics in which you are involved, that loves without restriction and accepts without judgment. If you desire to know your soul, the first step is to recognize that you have a soul. The next step is to allow yourself to consider, if I have a soul, what is my soul? What does my soul want? What is the relationship between my soul and me? How does my soul affect my life? When the energy of the soul is recognized, acknowledged, and valued, it begins to infuse the life of the personality. When the personality comes fully to serve the energy of its soul, that is authentic empowerment. This is the goal of the evolutionary process in which we are involved and the reason for our being. Every experience that you have and will have upon the earth encourages the alignment of your personality with your soul. Every circumstance and situation gives you the opportunity to choose this path, to allow your soul to shine through you, to bring into the physical world through you its unending and unfathomable reverence for and love of life. This is a book about authentic empowerment, the alignment of the personality with the soul, what that involves, how it happens, and what it creates. To understand these things requires an understanding of things that appear unusual to the five-sensory human, but they become natural once you understand evolution. That five-sensory perception is a journey leading to multi-sensory perception, and that you were not always meant to be five-sensory. Chapter 2. Karma. Most of us are accustomed to the belief that our participation in the process of evolution is limited to the duration of a single lifetime. This belief reflects the perspective of the five-sensory personality. From the point of view of the five-sensory personality, nothing of itself lasts beyond its lifetime, and there is nothing in the experience of the five-sensory human that is not of itself. The multi-sensory human, too, understands that nothing of itself lasts beyond its lifetime, but it is also aware of its immortal soul. The lifetime of your personality is one of a myriad of experiences of your soul. The soul exists outside of time. The perspective of the soul is immense, and the perception of the soul is without the limitations of the personality. Souls that have chosen the physical experience of life as we know it as a path of evolution have, in general, incarnated their energies many times into many psychological and physical forms. For each incarnation, the soul creates a different personality and body. The personality and the body that, for the five-sensory human, are the experiential entirety of its existence are, for its soul, the unique and perfectly suited instruments of a particular incarnation. Each personality contributes, in its own special way, with its own special aptitudes and lessons to learn, consciously or unconsciously, to the evolution of its soul. The life of a mother, a warrior, a daughter, a priest, the experiences of love, vulnerability, fear, loss, and tenderness, the struggles with anger, defiance, emptiness, and jealousy, all serve the evolution of the soul. Each physical, emotional, and psychological characteristic that comprises a personality in its body, strong or weak arms, dense or penetrating intellect, happy or despairing disposition, yellow or black skin, even hair and eye color, is perfectly suited to the soul's purpose. The five-sensory personality is not aware of the many other incarnations of its soul. A multi-sensory personality may be conscious of these incarnations, or experience them, as its own past or future lives. They are in its family of lives, so to speak, but they are not lives that it itself has lived. They are experiences of its soul. From the point of view of the soul, all of its incarnations are simultaneous. All of its personalities exist at once. Therefore, the release of negativity that occurs in one of the soul's incarnations benefits not only itself, but all of its soul's other incarnations also. Because the soul, itself, is not confined to time, the past of a personality, as well as its future, is enhanced when a personality releases currents of fear and doubt. As we shall see, the release of negativity by a personality benefits a great many other dynamics of consciousness as well. Some of these can be perceived by the five-sensory human, but appear to him or her neither as dynamics of consciousness nor as related to his or her inner processes, such as the consciousness and evolution of his or her sex, race, nation, and culture. Others extend far beyond the perceptual capability of the five-sensory human. A conscious lifetime, therefore, is a treasure beyond value. The personality and its body are artificial aspects of the soul. When they have served their functions, at the end of the soul's incarnation, the soul releases them. They come to an end, but the soul does not. After an incarnation, the soul returns to its immortal and timeless state. It returns once again to its natural state of compassion, clarity, and boundless love. This is the context in which our evolution occurs. The continual incarnation and reincarnation of the energy of the soul into the physical arena, into our earth school. Why does this happen? Why is it necessary even to speak of personalities and souls? The incarnation of a soul is a massive reduction of the power of the soul to a scale that is appropriate to a physical form. It is the reduction of an immortal life system into a framework of time and the span of a few years. It is the reduction of a perceptual system that partakes simultaneously through direct experience of countless lifetimes, some of them physical and some of them non-physical, to the five physical senses. The soul chooses, voluntarily, to undertake this experience in order to heal. The personality is those parts of the soul that require healing, along with those parts of the soul, such as compassion and love, that the soul has lent to the process of healing in that lifetime. The splintered aspects of the soul, the aspects that require healing, need to interact in physical matter so that each part of the splinteredness can become whole. The personality is like a complex mandala that is formed from these splintered parts in addition to the parts that are not splintered. It comes directly from the parts of the soul that the soul has chosen to work on in this lifetime to heal, that need to experience physical matter, and those parts that the soul has given to the process of healing in which you are involved. Therefore, you can see within a person's personality the splintered suffering of the soul from which it was formed, as well as the grace that the soul has earned, which is the loving part of the personality. Consider how powerful the soul is if it can have a part of itself that experiences great love, a part of itself that experiences fears, a part that is perhaps neutral, a part that experiences schizophrenia, and a part that is dramatically compassionate. If any of these parts are incomplete, the personality that the soul forms will be out of harmony. The harmonious personality is one in which the soul flows easily through the part of itself that is in touch with its physical incarnation. The soul is. It has no beginning and no end, but flows toward wholeness. The personality emerges as a natural force from the soul. It is an energy tool that the soul adapts to function within the physical world. Each personality is unique because the configuration of energy of the soul that formed it is unique. It is the persona of the soul, so to speak, that interacts with physical matter. It is a product that is formed from the vibrational aspect of your name, the vibrational aspect of your relationship to planets at the time of your incarnation, and vibrational aspects of your energy environment, as well as from the splintered aspects of your soul that need to interact in physical matter in order to be brought into wholeness. The personality does not operate independently from the soul. To the extent that a person is in touch with spiritual depths, the personality is soothed because the energy of consciousness is focused on its energy core and not on its artificial facade, which is the personality. The personality sometimes appears as a force running rampant in the world with no attachment to the energy of its soul. This situation can be the origin of what we call an evil human being, and it can be the origin of a schizophrenic human being. It is the result of the personality being unable to find its reference point or connection to its mothership, which is its soul. The conflicts of a human's life are directly proportional to the distance at which the energy of personality exists separately from the soul, and therefore, as we shall see, in an irresponsible position of creation. When a personality is in full balance, you cannot see where it ends and the soul begins. That is a whole human being. What is involved in the healing of a soul? Most of us are accustomed to the idea that we are responsible for some of our actions, but not all of them. We consider ourselves responsible, for example, for the good deed that brings our neighbor and us together, or for responding to it positively. But we do not consider ourselves responsible for the argument between us and our neighbor, or for responding to it negatively. We consider ourselves responsible for having a safe trip if we take the time to check the condition of the car before starting, but if we speed around a car that, in our opinion, has been traveling too slowly and almost cause an accident by doing that, we consider the other driver to be responsible. If we feed and clothe ourselves through our successful business, we credit ourselves. If we feed and clothe ourselves by burglarizing apartments, we blame our difficult childhood. For many of us, being held responsible is equal to getting caught. A friend who returns each year to his native Italy told me, with a twinkle in his eye, of a dinner out with his family. When the bill came, my friend's father, who is fastidious, examined each scribbled item. After some study, he deciphered the last entry and recognized it to be a short expression that translates, roughly, "If it goes, it goes." He called the waiter and asked, "What is this item?" The waiter shrugged. "It didn't go." Most of us feel that if a clerk gives too much change and we take it, our life has been affected only to the extent that we have come into an unexpected gain. In fact, each of our acts affects us in far-reaching ways. Every action, thought, and feeling is motivated by an intention, and that intention is a cause that exists as one with an effect. If we participate in the cause, it is not possible for us not to participate in the effect. In this most profound way, we are held responsible for our every action, thought, and feeling, which is to say, for our every intention. We ourselves shall partake of the fruit of our every intention. It is, therefore, wise for us to become aware of the many intentions that inform our experience, to sort out which intentions produce which effects, and to choose our intentions according to the effects that we desire to produce. This is the way that we learned about physical reality as children, and that we refine our knowledge of it as adults. We learn the effects of crying when we are hungry, and we repeat the cause that brings us the effect that we desire. We learn the effect of putting a finger in a light socket, and we do not repeat the cause that produces that effect. We also learn about intentions and their effects through our experiences in physical reality, but learning that intentions produce specific effects, and what those effects are, proceeds slowly when our learning must be done solely through the density of physical matter. Anger, for example, causes distance and hostile interactions. If we must learn this solely through physical experience, we may have to experience 10, or 50, or 150 circumstances of distance from another and hostile interaction before we come to understand that it is the orientation of anger on our part, the intention of hostility and distance, and not this particular action or that, which produces the effect that we do not want. This is predominantly the way that five-sensory humans learn. The relationship of cause and effect within the domain of physical objects and phenomena reflects a dynamic that is not limited to physical reality. This is the dynamic of karma. Everything in the physical world, including each of us, is a small part of dynamics that are more extensive than a five-sensory human can perceive. The love, fear, compassion, and anger that you experience, for example, are only a small part of the love, fear, compassion, and anger of a larger energy system that you do not see. Within physical reality, the dynamic of karma is reflected by the third law of motion. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. In other words, the great law of karma that governs the balancing of energy within our evolutionary system is reflected within the domain of physical objects and phenomena by the last of three principles, three laws of motion that govern the balancing of energy within physical reality. The law of karma is an impersonal energy dynamic. When its effects are personalized, that is, experienced from the point of view of the personality, they are experienced as a reversal in the direction, a coming back to the intender of the energy of his or her intention. This is how the personality experiences the impersonal dynamic that is described by the third law as an equal and opposite reaction. The person who intends hatred for others experiences the intention of hatred from others. The person who intends love for others experiences the intention of love from others, and so forth. The Golden Rule is a behavioral guide that is based upon the dynamic of karma. A personalized statement of karma would be, you receive from the world what you give to the world. Karma is not a moral dynamic. Morality is a human creation. The universe does not judge. The law of karma governs the balancing of energy within our system of morality and with those of neighbors. It serves humanity as an impersonal and universal teacher of responsibility. Every cause that has not yet produced its effect is an event that has not yet come to completion. It is an imbalance of energy that is in the process of becoming balanced. That balancing of energy does not always occur within the span of a single lifetime. The karma of your soul is created and balanced by the activities of its many personalities, including you. Often a personality experiences effects that were created by other of its soul's personalities, and conversely, creates energy imbalances that are not able to right themselves within its own lifetime. Therefore, without knowledge of its soul, reincarnation, and karma, it is not always possible for a personality to understand the significance or the meaning of the events of its life, or to understand the effects of its responses to them. For example, a personality that takes advantage of others creates an imbalance of energy that must be righted by the experience of being taken advantage of by others. If that cannot be accomplished within the lifetime of this personality, another of its soul's personalities will experience being taken advantage of by others. If that personality does not understand that the experience of being taken advantage of by others is the effect of a previous cause, and that this experience is bringing to completion an impersonal process, it will react from a personal point of view rather than from the point of view of its soul. It may become angry, for example, or vengeful or depressed. It may lash out or grow cynical or withdraw into sorrow. Each of these responses creates karma, another imbalance of energy which, in turn, must be balanced. In this way, one karmic debt has been paid, so to speak, but another, or others, has been created. If a child dies early in its life, we do not know what agreement was made between that child's soul and the souls of its parents, or what healing was served by that experience. Although we are sympathetic to the anguish of the parents, we cannot judge this event. If we, or the parents of this child, do not understand the impersonal nature of the dynamic that is in motion, we may react with anger towards the universe, or towards each other, or with guilt if we feel that our actions were inadequate. All of these reactions create karma, and more lessons for the soul to learn, more karmic debts for the soul to pay, appear. In order to become whole, the soul must balance its energy. It must experience the effects that it has caused. The energy imbalances in the soul are the incomplete parts of the soul that form the personality. Personalities in interaction are souls that are seeking to heal. Whether an interaction between souls is healing or not depends upon whether the personality involved can see beyond itself and that of the other personality to the interaction of their souls. This perception automatically draws forth compassion. Every experience and every interaction provides you with an opportunity to look from the point of view of your soul or from the point of view of your personality. What does this mean in practical terms? How does a personality begin to look beyond itself and to see its soul in interaction with the souls of others? Since we cannot know what is being healed through each interaction, what karmic debts are coming to conclusion, we cannot judge what we see. For example, when we see a person sleeping in the gutter in the winter, we do not know what is being completed for that soul. We do not know whether that soul has engaged in cruelty in another lifetime, and now has chosen to experience the same dynamic from an entirely different point of view, as, for example, the target of charity. It is appropriate that we respond to his or her circumstance with compassion, but it is not appropriate that we perceive it as unfair, because it is not. There are personalities that are selfish and hostile and negative, but even in these cases we cannot fully know the reasons why. These are hidden from view. That does not mean that we cannot recognize negativity when we see it, but we cannot judge it. That is not our place. If we intervene in an argument or break up a fight, it is not appropriate that we judge the participants. Of one thing we can be certain. A person who is engaging in violence is hurting deeply, because a healthy and balanced soul is incapable of harming another. When we judge, we create negative karma. Judgment is a function of the personality. When we say of another soul, "she is worthy," or "he is not worthy," we create negative karma. When we say of an action, "that is right," or "that is wrong," we create negative karma. This does not mean that we should not act appropriately to the circumstance in which we find ourselves. If our car is hit by another car, for example, and the driver of the other car is drunk, it is appropriate that the other driver be held responsible, through the courts, for the repair of our car. It is appropriate that he or she be prohibited from driving while intoxicated. It is not appropriate that we allow our actions to be motivated by feelings of indignation, righteousness, or victimization. These feelings are the results of judgments that we make about ourselves and the other person, assessments through which we see ourselves as superior to another being. If we act upon these feelings, not only do we increase the karmic obligations of our soul, but we also are not able to enter into these feelings and learn from them. Feelings, as we shall see, are the means through which we can discern the parts of itself that the soul seeks to heal and through which we come to see the action of the soul in physical matter. The road to your soul is through your heart. If we are to engage the viewpoint of the soul, we must cease from judging. Even those events that appear to be unfathomable, such as the cruelty of an inquisition or a holocaust, the death of an infant, the prolonged agony of a death by cancer, or a life confined to a bed. We do not know what is being healed in these sufferings, or the details of the energetic circumstance that is coming into balance. It is appropriate that we allow ourselves to feel the compassion that such circumstances call forth in us and to act upon it. But if we allow ourselves to judge these events, and those who participate in them, we create negative karma that must be balanced, and we, ourselves, will be among those souls that choose to participate in circumstances that are necessary to that balancing. If we do not judge, how can there be justice? Gandhi was beaten several times during his life. Although on two occasions he nearly died, he refused to prosecute his attackers because he saw that they were doing, quote, what they thought was right. This position of non-judgmental acceptance was central in Gandhi's life. The Christ did not judge even those who spit in his face and who subjected him without mercy to his pain and humiliation. He asked forgiveness, not vengeance, for those who tortured him. Did neither Christ nor Gandhi know the meaning of justice? They knew non-judgmental justice. What is non-judgmental justice? Non-judgmental justice is a perception that allows you to see everything in life, but does not engage your negative emotions. Non-judgmental justice relieves you of the self-appointed job of judge and jury because you know that everything is being seen. Nothing escapes the law of karma, and this brings forth understanding and compassion. Non-judgmental justice is the freedom of seeing what you see and experiencing what you experience without responding negatively. It allows you to experience directly the unobstructed flow of the intelligence, radiance, and love of the universe of which our physical reality is a part. Non-judgmental justice flows naturally from understanding the soul and how it evolves. This, then, is the framework of our evolutionary process. the continual incarnation and reincarnation of the energy of the soul into physical reality for the purposes of healing and balancing its energy in accordance with the law of karma. Within this framework, we evolve, as individuals and as a species, through the cycle of being unempowered to becoming empowered. Yet the experiences that we encounter in this process need not be the kind that we have encountered to now. Chapter 3. Reverence. The framework of karma and reincarnation in which we evolve is neutral. Actions and reactions in the physical arena set energy into motion, forming our experiences and revealing in the process the lessons that the soul has yet to learn. When our actions create discord in another person, we ourselves, in this lifetime or in another, will feel that discord. Likewise, if our actions create harmony and empowerment in another, we also will come to feel that harmony and empowerment. This allows us to experience the effects of what we have created, and thereby to learn to create responsibly. The framework of karma and reincarnation is impersonal, and provides for each soul, in response to the actions of its personalities, the experiences that it requires in order to evolve. Therefore, the orientation or the attitude with which a personality approaches the evolutionary process determines the nature of the experiences that will be required for the evolution of its soul. An angry personality, for example, will respond to the difficulties of its life with anger, and thereby bring into being the necessity of experiencing the results of anger. A sorrowful personality will respond sorrowfully and bring into being the necessity of experiencing the results of sorrow, and so on. A person who is angry and yet reveres life, however, will respond very differently to the difficulties of his or her life than a person who is angry and has no reverence for life. The person who has no reverence for life will not hesitate to strike out against life. The violence that is released in killing another person or another living creature is much greater than the violence that is released in speaking angry words. The karmic obligation, the energy imbalance that is created by killing, can be balanced only by the experience of a commensurate brutality. Thus, a person who is reverent will automatically be spared the severe karmic consequences of one who is not. Even if all of our species were reverent, that would not end the need for us to move through our own evolution. It would just change the quality of the learnings within the process of evolution. In other words, if we became reverent this day, we would not be exempt from the demands of our evolution. But the quality of the experiences that we would encounter would be different. We would not harm life. We would still learn the same thing, but in the process of learning, we would not seek to harm or to destroy. Our journey from powerlessness to authentic empowerment would continue, but the nature of that experience would change. We would not encounter the types of experiences that result from a perception of the world that lacks reverence. We see life as cheap. This perception pervades all our perceptions. When we look at the animal kingdom, for example, we see the activities within this kingdom as verification of our evaluation of life. We see animals kill and feed upon other animals, and we conclude that weaker forms of life exist only to nourish the stronger. We justify our exploitation of life that we perceive to be the design of nature. We maim and kill. We create situations in which millions of people starve while we store grain in silos and pour milk down drains. We look upon each other as prey to satisfy our emotional and physical needs. We say, it's a dog-eat-dog world, and that to survive in it we must take advantage of others before they take advantage of us. We look upon life as a contest that produces winners and losers. And we feel no restraints upon us when the needs of other people or other groups threaten us. Our behavior and values are so much shaped by perceptions that lack reverence that we do not know what it is like to be reverent. When we curse a competitor or strive to disempower another person, we absent ourselves from reverence. When we work to take instead of to give, we labor without reverence. When we strive for safety at the expense of another person's safety, we deprive ourselves of the protection of reverence. When we judge one person as superior and another as inferior, we depart from reverence. When we judge ourselves, we do the same thing. Business, politics, education, sex, raising families, and personal interactions without reverence all produce the same result. Human beings using other human beings. Our species has become arrogant. We behave as though the earth were ours, to do with as we please. We pollute its land, oceans, and atmosphere to satisfy our needs, without thinking of the needs of other life forms that live upon the earth, or of the needs of the earth. We believe that we are conscious and that the universe is not. We think and act as though our existence as living forces in the universe will end with this lifetime, and that we are responsible neither to others nor to the universe. It is not possible for a reverent person to exploit his friends or her friends, co-workers, city, nation, or planet. It is not possible for a reverent species to create caste systems, child labor, nerve gas, or nuclear weapons. Therefore, it is not possible for a reverent person or a reverent species to accumulate the type of karma that such activities create. Why is this? What is reverence? Reverence is engaging in a form and a depth of contact with life that is well beyond the shell of form and into essence. Reverence is contact with the essence of each thing and person and plant and bird and animal. It is contact with the interior of its beingness. Even if you cannot sense the interior, it is enough to know that the shell, the form, is merely an outer layer, and that underneath it, the true power and essence of who a person is, or what a thing is present. That is what is honored in reverence. Process is honored in reverence, the unfolding of life, the maturation process, the process of growing through and coming into your own empowerment, is a process that needs to be approached with reverence. The cycles of life need to be approached with reverence. They have been in place for billions of years. They are the reflection of the natural breathing of the soul of Gaia itself, the earth consciousness, as it moves its force fields and guides the cycles of life. If these are revered, how could we look at something as exquisite as our Earth's ecology and do one thing that would risk the balance of this system? Reverence is an attitude of honoring life. You do not have to be authentically empowered to be gentle with life or to love life. There are many people who are not authentically empowered, but who are quite reverent. They would harm nothing. Often it is the case that they are the most compassionate and the most loving people because they have suffered so much. Whether a person is reverent depends essentially upon whether he or she accepts the principle of the sacredness of life, any way that he or she defines sacred. Reverence is also simply the experience of accepting that all life is, in and of itself, of value. Reverence is not respect. Respect is a judgment. It is a response to the perception of qualities that we admire ourselves, or have been taught to admire. Qualities that are admired by the people of one culture may not be admired by the people of another culture, or by the people of a subculture, or by another generation of the same culture. Therefore, what is respected by some people may not be respected by others. It is possible to respect one person and not respect another. But it is not possible to revere one person without revering every person. Reverence is a perception, but it is a holy perception. The perception of holiness is not one that we use continually. It is one that we apply to religion, but not to the process of evolution or the learning process of the human life. And so we do not approach the need to learn. In all of the learning experiences of our life with regard for their purpose against the backdrop of spiritual development. Perceiving in this way is true reverence, because it allows you to look at what you are going through and to see it within the framework of the evolution and the maturation of your own spirit. It is true reverence because it enables you to look at all the evolutions that are taking place simultaneously with your own, in all of the kingdoms of life, and fully appreciate, or at least see very differently, how they unfold. Only when we see through eyes that lack reverence, for example, does the feeding of one animal upon another appear to be a cruel system, instead of one where species learn to give to each other, where there is a natural give and take and sharing of the energies between kingdoms. This is ecology. The natural redistribution of energy between kingdoms. It is only our kingdom, the human kingdom, that wants to warehouse energy, to use much more than it needs and to store what it does not, so that the balance of the cycle is disturbed so dramatically. If each of us took only what he or she needed for that day, it would be perfect. Animals do not warehouse like us, except in the case of animals that need to for winter. The perception of reverence allows us to see the interdependency of different species from a more comprehensive and compassionate perspective. It allows us to see the significance of each living creature and its experiences to the compassionate unfolding of the universe. This perspective is much less likely to create violent or destructive responses within us as we grow through our lives because it reveals in each moment the value of all life. Approaching and regarding life with an attitude of reverence permits the experience of being unempowered but not cruel. As you work toward becoming reverent, your tendencies toward harming others and other forms of life diminish. As you acquire a sense of reverence, you develop a capacity to think more deeply about the value of life before you commit your energy to action. When you are fully reverent, you cannot harm life, even though you are unempowered. Without reverence, the experience of being unempowered can become a very cruel one, because a disempowered person is a frightened person, and if a frightened person has no sense of reverence, he or she will harm or kill indiscriminately. Reverence is a level of protection and honor about the process of life, so that while a person is maturing toward the journey and through the journey of authentic empowerment, he or she harms nothing. Because we have no reverence, our journey to empowerment often includes the experiences of victimizing life. Therefore, there are victims and victimizers. The process of destroying life while we are learning about life that has characterized our evolution would cease, or at least would be very different, if we approached life with a quality of reverence. It is because we have no sense of reverence, no true belief in the holiness of all life, that life is destroyed and tortured, brutalized, starved and maimed while we journey from unempowerment to empowerment. If a sense of reverence were brought into the process of evolution, then as each of us, and our species, moves through the cycle of being unempowered to becoming empowered, the many learnings that are contained within that growing process of evolution would not likely produce violence and fear to the extent that is now experienced. The destructions of human life, plant life, animal life, and the planet would be considerably diminished, or would cease, if there were an active principle of reverence within our species. If there were the perception within our species and within each of us that although we are engaged in an evolutionary process that requires personal learning, that does not authorize us to destroy life while we are learning or because we are. We would not have the karmic energy of destruction, only of learning. Even though learning is contained in destruction, the karmic consequences of participating in violence and destruction are a high price to pay for it. It is not necessary, in other words, to learn what we need to learn and have it cost somebody his or her life. It is not necessary for progress and the experience of progress to cost the destruction of nature. It is not necessary. But without a sense of reverence, who cares that it destroys life? Without reverence, life becomes a very cheap commodity, as it is upon our planet now, where the entire process and the sacredness of evolution is not regarded, accepted, or honored. If we perceived life with reverence and understood our evolutionary process, we would stand in awe at the experience of physical life and walk the earth in a very deep sense of gratitude. As it is, there are billions of humans who are filled with regret that they are on the earth, with overwhelming experiences of pain, despair, discouragement, depression, starvation, and disease. These are the things of our planet. They result largely from the fact that so much of the human condition is without reverence. Reverence is a perception of the soul. Only the personality can perceive life without reverence. Reverence is a natural aspect of authentic empowerment, because the soul reveres all of life. Therefore, when the personality is aligned with the soul, it cannot perceive life except with reverence. Approaching life with reverence not only protects the soul from the karmic obligations that are created by personalities that do not honor life, but it also is a step toward moving the personality into alignment with the soul, because it brings an aspect of the soul directly into the physical environment. What does the decision to approach life with reverence mean in practical terms? It means challenging the perceptions and the values of a five-sensory world that lacks reverence. This is not always easy, especially for males who have been taught values that serve the accumulation of external power. An authentically empowered male will not be embarrassed or feel less than fully masculine by showing concern for life and for the many creatures on our planet. That is very much the energy of reverence. Therefore, the decision to approach life with reverence often requires courage, not only of men, but also of women who have adopted these values. The decision to become a reverent person is essentially the decision to become a spiritual person. There is currently no place for spirituality within science, politics, business, or academia. To a five-sensory personality that lacks reverence, a reverent businessman or businesswoman appears to be competing at a disadvantage, because the range of his or her activities is not unlimited, and a reverent politician appears to be unqualified for leadership in a world where the only power that is recognized is external power. Yet, to the multisensory human, a reverent businessman or businesswoman is a person who infuses a new energy into the archetype of entrepreneur, shifting it from a dynamic that is motivated by profits that are generated by serving others to a dynamic of serving others that is made possible by profits. And a reverent politician is a person who challenges the concept of external power and brings to the political arena the concerns of the heart. Therefore, the decision to approach life with reverence means acting and thinking as a spiritual person in a world that does not recognize spirit. And it means moving consciously toward the perceptions of the multisensory human. To live with reverence means being willing to say, "That is life. We must not harm it." And, "Those are our fellow humans. We must not destroy them." And mean it. It means re-examining the way that we treat the members of the animal kingdom that serve us so patiently. It means recognizing the rights of the earth. That the earth has rights is a concept that is not even present in our species yet. An attitude of reverence is the atmosphere, the environment, in which the multisensory personality evolves. It is a sense of richness and fullness and intimacy of being. It creates compassion and acts of kindness. Without reverence, without the perception of the holiness of all things, the world becomes cold and barren, mechanical and random at the same time, and this creates experiences of alienation and acts of violence. It is not natural for us to live without reverence, because that separates us from the basic energy of the soul. Reverence automatically brings forth patience. Impatience is the desire to have your needs met first. When your needs are taken care of, do you not then have patience with the needs of others? A reverent person honors life in all its forms and all its activities. It does not think in terms that are required to produce impatience. Reverence permits non-judgmental justice. The soul does not judge, and so the personality chooses to bring into physical reality another of its soul's characteristics when it chooses to approach life with reverence. The reverent person cannot consider himself or herself superior to another person or to any other form of life, because the reverent person sees divinity in all forms of life and honors it. An attitude of reverence facilitates the transition from the logic and understanding of the five-sensory human to the higher order of logic and understanding of the multisensory human, because, as we shall see, this higher order of logic and understanding originates in the heart. Without reverence, our experiences are brutal and destructive. With reverence, our experiences become compassionate and caring. We shall come to honor all of life sooner or later. Our choices are when that shall happen, and the quality of experience that we shall have as we learn. Chapter 4. Heart. The logics that have served our five-sensory exploration of physical reality cannot comprehend evolution without time or the influence of the present upon the past. They cannot meaningfully represent the existence of the soul or a dynamic of energy balancing that generates and links many lifetimes. They reflect no experiential points of reference beyond those of the five-sensory personality. Therefore, the time has come for a higher order of logic and understanding. The logics and understandings of the five-sensory personality originate in the mind. They are the products of the intellect. The higher order of logic and understanding that is capable of meaningfully reflecting the soul comes from the heart. The creation of this higher order of logic and understanding, therefore, requires close attention to feelings. The central position of the heart in the higher order of logic and understanding of the multisensory human, and the sensitivity to emotional currents that is characteristic of multisensory humans, appear as extraneous to the five-sensory personality because they do not serve the accumulation of external power. As we have come to seek and wield external power consciously, we have come to view feelings as unnecessary appendages, like tonsils, useless, but capable of creating pain and dysfunction. Thus, the pursuit of external power has led to a repression of emotion. This is true of us as individuals and as a species. The irrelevancy that we attribute to feelings pervades our thinking and our values. We admire the hard-nosed businessman who fires employees for the sake of external power. We reward the military officer who sends himself or others to pain and death for the sake of external power. We honor the statesman who is not swayed by compassion. When we close the door to our feelings, we close the door to the vital currents that energize and activate our thoughts and actions. We cannot begin the process of understanding the effects of our emotions upon us, our environment, and other people, or the effects of the emotions of other people upon themselves, their environment, and us. Without an awareness of our emotions, we cannot associate the effects of anger, sadness, grief, and joy within ourselves or others with their causes. We cannot distinguish between that part of us which is personality and that part of us which is soul. Without an awareness of our feelings, we cannot experience compassion. How can we share the sufferings and joys of others if we cannot experience our own? If we are not intimate with our emotions, we cannot perceive the dynamics that lie behind emotions, the way that these dynamics work, and the ends that they serve. Emotions are currents of energy that pass through us. Awareness of these currents is the first step in learning how our experiences come into being and why. Emotions reflect intentions. Therefore, awareness of emotions leads to awareness of intentions. Every discrepancy between a conscious intention and the emotions that accompany it points directly to a splintered aspect of the self that requires healing. If, for example, your intention to marry causes pain instead of joy, following the pain will lead you to unconscious intentions. If your intention to advance your work causes sorrow instead of satisfaction, following the sorrow will lead you to unconscious intentions. Without an awareness of your emotions, you are not able to experience reverence. Reverence is not an emotion. It is a way of being. But the path to reverence is through your heart. and only an awareness of your feelings can open your heart. The higher order of logic and understanding of the multisensory personality reveals connections where no connections are apparent to the five sensory personality, and meaning where there is no meaning apparent to the five sensory personality. A five sensory personality is not able to process fully the data of its senses. Its perception of reality is segmented. Its experience of the universe is partitioned. The five sensory personality can learn that internal dynamics affect perception and formulate this as folklore or cliché, such as, "Smile, and the world smiles with you." It can discover regularities within physical reality and formulate them as laws, such as, "A body in uniform motion will remain in uniform motion until it is acted upon by a force." Yet the five-sensory personality is not able to experience the relationships between these domains, and, therefore, is not able to learn about one from the other. It is not able to experience the same richness through each. Science, for example, reflects the divine impulse to become conscious of relationships that connect apparently separate aspects of experience. It is the pinnacle achievement of the five-sensory personality. Yet when the fruits of science are grasped only with the logic and understanding of the five-sensory human, internal dynamics, feelings, and intentions appear to be unrelated to the world of matter. Neither supernovas, nor subatomic decay rates, nor anything in between appear to be affected by what human beings feel or think. When the discoveries of science are comprehended with the logic and understanding of the multisensory human, intimate relationships appear between internal dynamics and regularities that govern physical phenomena. To the multisensory human, for example, a body in uniform motion will remain in uniform motion until it is acted upon by a force, reflects not only a dynamic at work within the realm of time and space and matter, but also a deeper dynamic that works within non-physical reality as well. How is this? One of my friends in infantry officer candidate school was a tall, affable, and pleasant-looking young man from Kentucky named Hank. Hank and I liked each other early on. Several times he lent me his physical strength when my load became too heavy, and I helped him through intellectual obstacles, such as calculating artillery trajectories. We shared adventures, and our friendship grew. Upon graduation, we were assigned to different organizations. I lost track of Hank until I ran into him in Saigon. He had been wounded, and due to the befriending of an army general, had been assigned to a unit that I came frequently to visit. While serving in Saigon, he met a popular female radio announcer, and they became engaged. It seemed a perfect match. A tall, handsome captain, and a beautiful and admired public figure. I again lost track of Hank until I had left the army. He called me to say that his wife was coming to make an appearance at a resort near me, and he asked me to meet him there. When I met Hank, now a civilian also, he looked troubled and his easygoing manner was dampened. He had changed his name to Hal, he told me, and apologized that his wife was unable to join us. We spoke for a while, and when I asked him what he was doing with himself, he told me, "Looking for my place in the sun." The next news that I heard of Hank, Hal, was that he had killed himself. When I was later able to meet his widow, she told me a painful story of marital difficulties, of Hank's despondency, and of his suicide. In the years immediately following the Vietnam War, the rate of suicides among Vietnam veterans was significantly higher than the rate of suicides among non-veterans. Therefore, it is likely that Hank, also, was affected adversely by his experiences in Vietnam. Yet there was also a more common dynamic at work in my friend. Hank was not the kind of person to ask himself deeper questions about his life. He did not inquire into the deeper meaning of his existence upon the earth, because that would have caused him to change his life, and he did not want to do that. He lived his life without much reflection, and one day he awoke to overwhelming emptiness and powerlessness. How does my friend's life relate to the first law of motion, which says, "A body in uniform motion will remain in uniform motion until it is acted upon by a force"? What does uniform motion mean in terms of a human life? and what is the force that alters that motion. The outward events of Hank's life were not uniform. He grew up on a farm in Kentucky, became a military officer,